Order, I guess we can just take testimony because we only have three of us. So it is 1:10 and the date is the 15th of February, and we're on record but only for the purposes of taking testimony since we only have three members present, Representative Coghill, Wilson, and myself, McGuire. So we don't have a quorum to do official business yet, but we're going to go ahead and start with Senate Bill 20, Offenses Against Unborn Children. We have the bill's sponsor, Senator Dyson, and on the Senate side, and also in the audience is Representative Bob Lynn, who is the House version sponsor as well, and has put a lot of hard work into it. So without further ado, Senator Dyson.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you expect others to join us?
Yes.
Okay. What version do you understand you have before you?
R.
Okay.
And that's the version that passed the Senate.
Yeah, and we were a bit confused about that, but that's okay. The U version had an amendment that Senator Guess added that we thought had value, and it basically makes it very clear that a woman who stays in an abusive domestic violence relationship could not be charged with reckless behavior. And so if you in your wisdom choose to put that back in, we would support that.
Page 3, lines 14 through 19 on the U version. Yeah. Thank you so much, Senator.
All right. So, it appears two places, identical language in two places. We can deal with that later.
Got it.
All right. So, I've always wanted sometimes in our deliberations to deal with issues that aren't just numbers, and this is one of those opportunities. This is a bill that establishes that the damaging or the killing of an unborn child is a separate crime, separate from the harm that might have occurred to the mother. And the federal government has passed an Unborn Child Protection Act, and we brought this one forward after discussions with the Attorney General because the federal one only applies on federal lands or in the prosecution of federal crimes. Much of what happens in our state, assault and murder manslaughter, is prosecuted in state court by state prosecutors, and so the Attorney General was clear with us that this was of value so that these issues could be brought forth in state court. And so and about 30 other states have done what, in one form or another, what is before you today, and establish a crime against an unborn child as a separate crime in the statutes. Back in 1969, California cops got into a wrong apartment and a drug bust at dark. And they were pretty nervous, and the lady of the house came out of a side room with a Kirby vacuum cleaner holding it across her body, and a nervous cop shot her and killed her unborn child. And complete mistake, perhaps understandable, but they realized that when they started deal with it, that there was no statutes that allowed any action, both civil or criminal, for the child. They could certainly deal with the assault and the injury to the woman and her costs and so on, but there was nothing in California law that established the value of the child that was lost. And the quickest action at that time that the California legislature had ever done, they passed one of the first in the country piece of legislation establishing the value of the unborn child, the wanted unborn child, as a separate entity. And we went to several sources but got model legislation from a couple of different sources, and then had excellent help from the Department of Law and Ledge Legal to craft what is before you. And it establishes, adds in unborn child in several places in the code, and you'll see. And then it goes back and deals with the specific incidences that come up in that are peculiar to an unborn child. This has been a great learning experience for me, and I've got a little glimpse of why some of you really love the study of the law. And for me, it's like reading Talmudic logic discussions. But every question that came up, I realized that our legal system has dealt with in a logical and clear way. And Ms. Campanetti, who's probably behind me here somewhere, has superintended mentoring my education in all of this. You will probably hear some testimony that this bill could be construed to be anti-abortion. And if you want, I can show you citations from several legal experts and law school faculty establishing that that's not an issue that at all. And we have made very clear here that an abortion this speaks nothing to abortion, and it does nothing to a damage to an unborn child that might happen during diagnostic or therapeutic work or and so on, done by in a hospital or by a doctor and so on. So there's, from my perspective and the citations we can share with you, there is no impact on either abortion as a right or the abortion industry. I think that, in my own view, that some of that testimony you'll hear is fueled by the kind of cognitive dissonance that a bill like this brings up, because it makes it very clear that we, if we pass this, will be establishing that a unborn child is an entity worthy of protection and recognition in the law, just as we have done for moose or sheep, you know, and so on. But without this kind of action, an unborn child has little or no protection under law. The other issue that will come up is, what happens if you harm a pregnant woman and you don't know she's pregnant? And the law is clear on that. If you had evil intentions towards the woman and carried them out, then your intentions are transferable. Just like if you broke into my house and took a shot at me when I'm in bed and one of my granddaughters is laying there beside me and you didn't know it, you know, but your shot went through my body and got her, you know, because you had evil intentions towards me, the law establishes that that intention is transferable. The most dramatic case like that we've had here in Alaska just 3-4 years ago, some gentlemen were in contention over the affections of a woman, and one of them had the child under his jacket, which is, you know, a prevalent way to carry small children, at least in Western Alaska that I'm familiar with. And the other guy started hitting the guy with a baseball bat and killed the child that was under his coat. And the child died 18 hours later or something. And because he had evil intention towards the man and damaged the child, he could be charged for the damage to the child. And it's very logical. As you read this through, one way it's been helpful for me to look at it, the actions for which you can be charged are just the same as if the child had been born. So if just think about it that way. And Ms. Carpinetti has helped me understand that in order to have a crime, you need to have harm. You know, there has to be harm, and it has to be demonstrable harm. You have to have had intention and an instrument for causing the harm. You got to have all three elements in order to have a chargeable crime and a conviction. And I think we've been very careful here in this law that makes that true. And many other things will come up, and I'll be glad to answer them and deal with them as they do.
Thank you, Senator Dyson. So, Senator Dyson, besides in the R version, the only difference in the R version, or I'm asking the question, is the only difference in the R version the deletion of the domestic violence provisions?
To the best of my knowledge.
Okay.
And I will make very sure of that before I see you Wednesday next.
Okay. Because what I'd like to do, and then we can see if there are any other differences, I'd like to have a motion to adopt the U version then before this committee, which would save this committee's time with respect to the domestic violence provisions. Okay. Representative Wilson.
I so move that we go ahead and use the U version and have that version before us. Okay.
And so the motion is to adopt the U version as our working document. Is there an objection to that?
Madam Chair, just
Representative
briefly,
Guerra?
I'm looking for the U version.
Okay. Shalon will give you a copy if you...
Can you just tell me while I'm waiting again? I'm sorry, I missed the beginning of the meeting. What's the substantive difference
and
between
so Senator Dyson started out by saying that there were provisions that Senator Guest had amended in that were removed that he was supportive of being back in. Page 2, starting at line 5 through 10, is the first reference to it. And but you need the... She's looking for it. Do you have it yet? Do you have you?
No, I don't. Maybe I do, but I just can't find it.
Let's take a brief at ease. The first reference is page 2, lines 5 through 10. And the second reference is on page 3, lines 14 through 19. And those are the two offenses. And so I'd prefer to start from this document, which retains those, rather than having to go through that amending process. So the motion before us is to adopt version U as our committee version. So is there an objection to that? Okay, hearing no objection, we have version U properly before us then. Questions for Senator Dyson? Okay, no questions. So I've got 5 people to testify. I'll go ahead and take their public testimony. I'll go just in order of how they've been handed to me, starting in the Anchorage LIO, Michael McLeod Ball.
Madam Chair, just
Representative
briefly,
Guerra.
Again, I was late and I missed this, but what's your intention as to when to do amendments, when to debate, and when to vote on the bill?
We will mark up the bill next Wednesday. So between now and then, and I would ask if people could put their amendments in writing so that we can see them clearly, and so next Wednesday. Okay, so today we're just going to take public testimony and close that out so we can save time for next Wednesday. Okay, yes.
Sorry,
that's okay. Representative Coghill, you're excused. Thank you very much. And Representative Guerra and Cott joined us at about 1:20, so just for the record. Okay, so Mr. Ball, are you there?
I am, Madam Chair. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Okay. My name is Michael McLeod Ball. I'm the executive director of the ACLU of Alaska. I'm coming to you today to oppose Senate Bill 20. I will just say at the outset that we fully support the efforts to punish the acts of violence against women that would harm or terminate a wanted pregnancy. But the proposal that's before you would do so in a way that diminishes the woman who is typically the intended victim by separating the fetus from the woman in the eyes of the law. Instead, we support alternate approaches, including enhanced penalties for cases in which a woman suffers harm to herself or to her pregnancy, to her wanted pregnancy. According to the Bureau of Justice statistics, a third of women murder victims are killed by their intimate partner. According to a study in the Maternal and Child Health Journal, 4-8% of all pregnant women in this country are battered by the men in their lives. The highest rate is among pregnant adolescents. A 2001 study shows that homicide is the number one killer of pregnant women. All this is to show that the intent of the perpetrator is to harm the woman, not the child. It may be that the woman's pregnancy heightens the likelihood of battery, but the intent is to harm the woman. And there's no evidence to suggest, generally, an intent to harm the fetus in these attacks. we want to do something about this problem, and it is a problem, punishing the effects, acting after the fact, does not do it. We need to address the issues ahead of time. Let me just offer some additional tangential comments. We're particularly concerned that the current bill does not exempt a pregnant woman from criminal liability. And I would just ask you to consider the following series of postulations. Privacy right guarantees a woman the right to control her own body in the absence of compelling state interest. Roe interprets that right to protect the right to abortion. This law criminalizes activity that, with respect to the fetus, is less harmful than abortion. So if a woman has the right to abort under constitutional standards, does it not stand to reason that she ought to have the right to do other things during her pregnancy that fall short of abortion? But in this case, she would be put at least in risk of criminal liability. This bill will encourage more abortions. I would ask you to consider the following hypothetical. Let's assume that a woman is anxious that some activity that she is engaged in during pregnancy may result in harm to her fetus. Why should she risk criminal liability under this law when the woman could simply abort the fetus? It stands to reason that there will be some number of women who may choose that as an option. And so therefore, oddly enough, this bill would tend to encourage more abortions in Alaska. This bill unfairly penalizes wholly innocent and legal behavior. Let's assume a woman is pregnant but does not know that she is pregnant, and she engages in high-risk activity that might otherwise expose her potentially to criminal liability under this statute. She should not be subject to that criminal liability under these circumstances. There are also a whole host of proof and legal procedural issues that are raised by this legislation. I think the position could be taken by the proponents that is not the intent of this law to subject some of these hypothetical circumstances to criminal liability, but yet the language is there to support it, and so therefore what's going to happen is there will be some prosecutor somewhere who, notwithstanding the proponents' expressions in these legislative hearings, will bring some sort of case against a woman. And it will be left to that woman to defend herself rather than to go about her life freely as she ought to be able to do. In addition, there will be additional costs to the state that I think are not being considered here, particularly as they relate to the various scientific costs that will be necessary to prove or disprove the various elements of the criminal liability that's established here. In short, we simply oppose this bill. We think it's a bad bill. We are in favor of heightening penalties against those who would harm women who are pregnant, particularly where there is damage to the fetus. I want to believe in the good faith of this bill's sponsor. I do believe that the sponsors are concerned with children and with fetuses and with abortions. But I don't believe that the proponents are concerned with finding a consensus on this issue, because if so, there wouldn't be language in here such as the constant reference to unborn children. And there would be more of an attempt to agree upon the common ground of heightening sentencing for those who engage in activities that result in harm to fetuses. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Ball. And can you, just looking through the bill, what part of the bill do you think puts a woman in a position of being charged with a crime for negligence or reckless activity? I would like to hear where you're referring, because as I read it, if you're using a dangerous instrument, the mental intent of recklessly comes in. But otherwise, it's intentionally or knowingly. So I only see reference to reckless as a mental intent when in combination with a dangerous instrument, which to me gets around your, you know, judgment call cases on the part of a woman. But could you speak to that? I know you're an attorney too, so.
Yeah, I'll speak to it generally, and I'd be happy to provide you with some written commentary that might be more specific on it.
Okay.
One of the big issues is the notion of who gets to decide who's charged here. And while there may be a common understanding of what particular terms mean, how that gets carried into practice is a whole other ball of wax. The bottom line is that there is no specific exemption for a woman's own actions, which I think should clearly be a part of this bill. And again, as I said, I'd be happy to be more specific in some sort of written form to the committee.
So your testimony is that if a woman is intentionally causing or recklessly causing serious physical injury to the unborn child with a dangerous instrument, that she should not be responsible for that?
No, that's your interpretation, perhaps, of my testimony, but that's not my testimony.
Okay. Well, I'll see it in writing then. Questions? Okay. Representative Guerra?
Yeah. I do have a question. In current law, we define serious physical injury as, in the criminal code, in AS 1181-900, we define serious physical injury that a defendant causes as including injury that unlawfully terminates a pregnancy. So you cause a miscarriage, that constitutes serious physical injury. It seems to me that we have aggravating factors that can change a sentence that goes in the presumptive range of, let's say, 10 to 20 years. You can bring it all the way up to 99 years in an unclassified felony and a Class A felony, I believe, if you prove aggravators. It seems appropriate to me to have an aggravator that makes clear that if it's serious physical injury that you cause, and I'm not sure if that's very clear in the law right now, it might be intended, but if you cause serious physical injury, which would include the termination of a pregnancy, that should lead to a higher sentence, and that might be the appropriate way to go about addressing this issue where somebody recklessly causes a miscarriage. I guess, what are your thoughts as to that approach?
I think there's probably some merit to that approach, and again, without speaking specifically to the statutes that you referenced, because I don't have those in front of me, I think that concept is worthy of examination, and I think it's an area where all sides on this issue could agree.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. McLeod Ball.
Thank you.
Okay, next I have in the Mat-Su Valley, Karen Vosburgh-Lewis.
Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of this committee. Thank you for hearing this very important bill. There are currently 32 states that recognize the killing of an unborn child as homicide in at least some circumstances. And of these states, there are 20 states with homicide laws that recognize unborn children as victims throughout the whole period of prenatal development. It is well established that this type of legislation does not conflict with the Supreme Court's pro-abortion decrees, such as Roe v. Wade. Criminal defendants have brought many legal challenges to the state unborn victim laws based on Roe and other constitutional arguments, but all such challenges have been rejected by the courts. In 1989, case of Webster versus Reproductive Health Services, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to invalidate a Missouri statute that declares that the life of each human being begins at conception, that unborn children have protectable interests in life, health, and well-being, and that all state laws shall be interpreted and construed to acknowledge on behalf of the unborn child at every stage of development all rights, privileges, and immunities available to other persons, citizens, and residents of this state to the extent permitted by the Constitution and U.S. Supreme Court rulings. I'm very happy to present some recent information about national polls that show more and more people understand what's going on here. A scientific Newsweek poll released June 1st of last year asked people whether someone who kills a fetus still in the womb, quote-unquote, should face a homicide charge for that act, either throughout pregnancy or from the point of viability or not at all, 56% said throughout pregnancy, and another 28% said it viability, for a total of 84% of our population of this nation. Only 9% said that there should be no such thing as fetal homicide charge. Also in May of last year, a national Fox News poll found that 84% favored a double homicide charge in the Peterson murder case in California, while only 7% favored a single homicide charge. This is common sense legislation, and I thank you all for bringing this forward, and please do pass it through. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Karen, and you must have gotten married.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yes, maybe I didn't hear this, but usually we ask people if they're affiliated with a group or are held an officer post in a group relevant to the legislation that's before us. Could you please tell us who you represent?
Oh, yes, thank you, Representative Gruenberg. I meant to do that. I am the executive director for Alaska Right to Life, and I represent now about over 60,000 people who are pro-life in this state, more like about 66,000 people.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to go to Fairbanks. I have two folks in Fairbanks. The first is Brenda Stanfill. Looks like with the Interior Alaska Center for Nonviolent Living.
Yes, hello.
Please offer your testimony.
Thank you. We spent a lot of time on this bill last year, and so starting again this year, we still have the same situation going on that we had last year. We do appreciate the work that was done in exempting victims of domestic violence for staying in a relationship that they could not be charged based solely on staying in a relationship. But it still goes back to that until we do a better job of protecting a woman, we're not going to be able to protect her child. And while it's very unfortunate in the Peterson situation, and I understand the need for additional crimes and those kind of things, I do believe that this bill is going about it in the wrong way. I see that we have defined words. I also agree with the gentleman who testified earlier that it's still going to be up to some prosecutorial discretion. In our community, we see that often, and this could be used against a woman. My biggest concern here is the crimes against a woman whose own child has been lost. I'm also concerned that a woman may decide not to seek help when she's having problems during her pregnancy, because she knows that he has beat her repeatedly. This may lead to her not getting health care. It may lead to her ultimate death if she miscarries at home and doesn't receive the adequate health care she needs. She may not report if she knows he's going to be charged with a crime. It would be much better served in our community and in our state if we would look at making this the crime against the woman with aggravating factors and additional penalties when an unborn child is involved. We do know at the shelter, we see many women who their first incidents of physical assault happened while they were pregnant. There seems to be something about the ability to control during that time maybe is easier. But it is very important that we keep this in context. If this is a crime against a woman, and put the penalties there where we can make women safe, start really looking at what we need to do in order to increase those penalties for men who are abusing women who are pregnant. And to keep in mind that the women should not be in danger of being prosecuted for a crime.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Stanfill. Okay, next I have Michael, Representative Gruenberg, briefly.
Ms. Stanfill, you mentioned the problems with people who are abused during pregnancy. Do you see any need for other enhancements or additional crimes to protect them, as long as we're looking at the whole criminal syndrome here?
We really do. We need to look at that a man can physically abuse a woman over and over again with his fist, be charged with fourth degree assault. I have one gentleman we've been working with at our alternative to violence program that first time he's come through, this is his 15th offense against this woman, and this is still a misdemeanor charge with little to no jail time. And we really do not do an adequate job in our laws in making sure that women see that we really need to, we do want to protect them as a community, and we're going to take this serious, and we're going to make the jail time fit the crime.
Mrs.
Really
Stanfield, thank you, and I appreciate it. That question is really off the scope of this bill, and I do appreciate your answer. And anytime you and Representative Gruenberg want to get together and work on legislation, I would wholeheartedly support it. I don't disagree whatsoever, but the focus of the bill today is not that.
Madam Chair.
And so, Representative Gruenberg?
This is more of a parliamentary inquiry than anything else.
Okay.
Would you hold it out of order were I to offer such an amendment to this bill?
No, I would not hold it out of order.
Then I would ask that you allow...
It would be markup on Wednesday.
I would ask that you allow brief testimony on that to support such an amendment, which
okay,
I will offer.
I think she gave it.
Thank you, because I'm just putting people on notice that I intend to offer an amendment to felonize repeat sexual assaults against a woman in violation of a domestic violence order or something, particularly if there's a pregnancy involved. And I will offer such an amendment, and I would welcome any testimony by anyone else on that subject today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I don't see a problem, you know, you get with the sponsor of the bill. We might have to amend the title. So
I'll offer that, too.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Michael Smith. It looks like the University of Alaska Fairbanks Students for Life.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Go ahead and offer your testimony. And if you can try to keep it to 2 minutes, I would appreciate it. I've got four more people, and then we're going to cut off testimony on this today and go on to the next bill.
I'll be better than that. I support any bill that would criminalize the destruction of an unborn child. And I support any bill that would add, that would strengthen the penalties against a violent individual who would commit such an act. And that's it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Okay, and for the other four that are online, if you heard my plea to please keep it to 2 minutes, I would appreciate it. Pamela Marsh in Anchorage. Ms. Marsh, are you there? Okay. Mr. Jacobus.
Can you hear me?
There you are. Okay.
Okay. My name is Pamela Marsh, and I work very long hours. I'm slightly or very much overweight. It all depends how you look at it. And I'm 43 years old, which would mean that I would be an older mother. If I was pregnant and I was advised probably to get bad breath and I was needed to go to work to help feed my children, could I be prosecuted under this bill? And you would say, oh, no, absolutely not. But if you look at it with the intent to cause the death of an unborn child, it could be read that way because I was advised to stay home and to get plenty of bed rest. I'm not to have much salt. It gets me way too high of blood pressure. By golly, I love salt. If I overdid my salt, could I be prosecuted? These are choices that I would make to go to work to feed my children. To eat a little bit too much salt would be a choice that I would make. These are choices that, yes, I probably shouldn't. Stay in bed, put my feet up, and take it easy. But I just couldn't do it. And too many things would depend on me to make sure that things ran appropriately. And I know that the people in that room understand what I'm talking about. And I know that this is not the intent of this bill, but it could be read into it. And on a final note, if I was a woman who was an abuser of drug and alcohol, which I am not, thank God, would I be so fearful to go and get help that I would not get help because I think that I would be prosecuted under this bill? These are the serious questions, and I know you've said over and over it doesn't, but if you read it between the lines, this is the way it could be interpreted. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you. There is or there was a provision in an earlier version of this bill that exempted actions by the woman concerning herself. I don't see that in the first judiciary CS. I'm not sure what version that was in. But, ma'am, do you understand what I have just mentioned on the record here?
I do, and I'm not able to see it, but I am here to, as a concerned person, in the choices that I make as a person who needs to support my children and my family.
Thank you, because I may well offer such an amendment here that would, I think, cure your problem. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Ms. Marsh, for your hard work as a mom and your testimony. Okay, Mr. Ken Jacobus.
Hi, Ken Jacobus here. Can you hear me?
Okay, go ahead and a couple minutes of testimony, please.
I'll keep mine very short. I'm an attorney here. I think many of the members of the committee know me. I'm not going to go into the details of the bill or argue any of the details. I'm just going to say this, that like the federal government and the other states, we need to enact the law in Alaska to protect the rights of unborn children against being harmed knowingly or negligently by third parties. I'm less concerned about people being prosecuted where they shouldn't be prosecuted because we have prosecutorial discretion in just about any criminal law. The prosecutors, with their experience, can determine which cases are appropriate for prosecution and which aren't. And they won't prosecute cases which are inappropriate or which they're not going to get any convictions on. And finally, the idea of an action by a woman concerning herself being an exemption is too broad because there are certain things that a woman can do which concern herself, which should be criminal. Suppose she just takes a pair of scissors and stabs herself in the abdomen. Right, that, with the intent of destroying her unborn child. That's too broad an exception, so if you're going to put an exception like that into it, it's got to be narrowed. But we do need the bill and work on the details, and I thank you for your interest in this matter.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gruenberg.
Yes, Mr. Jacobus, I appreciate your comment there. If you would have, what I had been looking at was the French Amendment, page 2, line 13, I believe, and if you would have some ability to take to access that was offered, I think, on the floor of the Senate. And if you would have any proposed narrowing language that you would interested in seeing on that, please fax it to me, 465-3766. I'd like your advice on this, Ken.
465-3766?
Yep.
And the French Amendment is where?
We'll get it to you.
Okay, I appreciate that.
Thank you.
My fax is 264-6666.
We've got it.
Just remember the mark of the beast plus one.
Yeah, got it. Thanks.
Thank
nice to hear from you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Jacobus. Okay, Debbie Jocelyn in OffNet.
Thank you.
And Debbie, it's just a couple minutes today.
I understand.
Thank
you. My name is Debbie Jocelyn. I reside in Delta Junction. I represent Eagle Forum Alaska, and it's over 1,000 members statewide. And I want to thank you for hearing this bill. We support this bill, and we urge you to pass Senate Bill 20. And there's been much talk. I won't say much except that we're in a society where we're supposed to value human life and protect women. Women are increasingly the victims of violence. In a study of autopsies of women, 32% of non-pregnant women were victims of homicide, but 43.3% of pregnant women were victims of homicide. 75% of those were women who died from gunshot trauma, and 3 out of 4 women with evidence of pregnancy were victims of homicide in their first 20 weeks of pregnancy. This suggests that women aren't always the primary victim, that a lot of times it is the unborn child who is the primary victim. And we end up with 2 people getting hurt seriously or killed. And in the case of Lacey Peterson, if you talk to her family, they'll tell you they're grieving for 2 people, not just 1. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Jocelyn. Questions? Okay, Clover Simon and then Chip Wagner, and then I'm going to close public testimony today. Clover?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Okay. This is Clover Simon. I'm the CEO for Planned Parenthood of Alaska, and my testimony is on behalf of Planned Parenthood. First off, I would like to say that we definitely share Senator Dyson's goal of making it a greater crime when there is a loss of pregnancy because of violence. However, at this time, we're unable to support the bill as it's currently written, and we do continue to view this legislation as part of a national trend designed to erode the foundations of a woman's right to choose by elevating the legal status of all stages of prenatal development under state law. I suggest, and we have been working toward an alternative, which I think we all can agree on, which would be a penalty enhancement approach that would make it 1 felony count higher to harm a pregnant woman when the result is miscarriage or stillbirth. We have consulted with our legal staff and have learned this approach is more likely to reach offenders because the language is cleaner and it is less likely that the two separate charges will be joined in prosecution. If it's just an aggravator, it makes it simpler. The resulting penalty would be as stiff as the penalties outlined in the current version of SB 20. I'm also concerned that there is not an exception for actions that a mother may take against herself. In particular, I would point you in the direction of, I believe it's on page 3, section 2, the provisions within the first and second degree assault sections. The language now says that premature birth before 37 weeks or the birth of a baby weighing less than 5.5 pounds is prima facie evidence of serious physical injury. And I would urge you to look at this and consider how this might affect women and how women might be prosecuted under this section. And I'm going to keep it short. And in closing, I would like to remind you all that the protection of the woman must come first. It's their safety and well-being that allows us to have healthy babies. Without safe moms, we can't have healthy babies. And SB 20 seems to have left this part out. So I urge you not to play politics with women's health. And please work with us to create a bill that everyone can support. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Clover. Okay, and then Chip Wagner. Oh, pardon me, Representative Gruenberg and then Gara.
Yes, ma'am, Clover. You mentioned a different section here than I've heard testimony on. I apologize. I was unable to be detained here. Page 3, lines 23 through 25, proposed AS 1148-280 subsection B, which says in a prosecution under this section, unless it's multiple births, the birth of a child before 37 weeks gestation with birth weight of 2,500 grams or less is prima facie evidence of serious physical injury.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have problems with that section?
Well, if there isn't an exception for exemptions that a woman makes against herself, say a woman is smoking during her pregnancy, which is a known cause of low birth weight and also preterm labor, could she be prosecuted under this bill? Those would be the kinds of questions that I would be interested in knowing the answer to.
I see. I was thinking of other questions as well, because you could have a premature baby with low birth weight and there's no physical injury at all.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Well, and just, you know, and we'll discuss this on Wednesday, but I urge members to look at what the language of a dangerous instrument. I mean, you can get pretty far afield in some of these fact patterns. I don't know that a cigarette would be a dangerous instrument. So maybe the focus ought to be on the definition of what a dangerous instrument is, because nowhere in the bill, there's either intentional conduct. The only place it lowers down to reckless conduct, which we know what that is, a conscious disregard of a known risk, the only place reckless is ever used is in concert with the use of a dangerous instrument. There's nowhere in this bill where the two are not linked. So that's really important, and that was important to me. And so it's something that I just really urge you to focus in on, because there are these fact patterns that get out there about people skiing and, you know, bowling and whatever. And those are really your negligent fact patterns. And so you're up to the reckless, and with reckless, you're with a dangerous instrument. And beyond that, you're to intentional conduct.
I understand, Madam Chair, but I would focus your attention on page 3, lines 14 through 19, a person knowingly engages in conduct that results in serious physical injury, which could be a premature low birth weight baby. And if a person intentionally lights and smokes a cigarette, that seems to be knowingly engaging in conduct, would be under sub C. And in fact, if, as we're talking about just now with Clover, you're smoking and you know that may very well harm the baby, might that cigarette not be considered a dangerous instrumentality under the facts of that case?
Yeah, and we'll debate it on Wednesday, but I cannot imagine a prosecutor in this state making the argument that a woman intended to cause serious physical injury to her unborn child by smoking. I can't see it, but I want to hear the debate.
I've seen a lot of things recently that I couldn't have imagined either.
Maybe I'm thinking in a different way. Okay, Representative Gara had questions.
Actually, I've got one question, but I just, on this, the whole thing of use of a dangerous instrument, normally the dangerous instrument is a weapon, and we understand that you would want to have an enhanced crime when somebody misuses a weapon and causes a very serious injury, but and I wonder whether we should consider substituting dangerous instrument for weapon. When you use dangerous instrument and you talk about negligent homicide, then you're talking about a bad car accident that causes a miscarriage, and all of a sudden the person is liable for a manslaughter, or actually, negligent homicide of that resulted in the miscarriage. And I don't think that that's what folks intend, to also cover car accidents, but a car is a dangerous instrument. That's the one example I can think of where you're not really using a weapon, but you're using something that's a dangerous instrument.
And it would be a reckless mental intent, but you can envision it would, so it could maybe be like going, you know, at 75 miles an hour, or maybe driving driving under the influence. Representative Wilson.
Where does the baseball bat fit in there?
Dangerous instrument.
That'd be a dangerous instrument.
Madam Chair.
Representative Groover.
Are there cases from the Alaska Supreme and Appellate Courts holding that a boot is a dangerous instrument and a telephone's a dangerous instrument? Not in the sense that other people might think, but when they hit them over the head with a telephone.
See, those are the cases I think you want to get at. I mean, that's me. But
sure.
But I understand, and Clover, really, I respect your testimony, because I know where you're headed, and I think you you make some good points, but I feel like the bill has been, really cleaned up, and so there may be some places we still need to massage, but I don't see the cigarette thing, but again, maybe try to convince me next time. Okay, Representative Anderson has joined us, and I have only one other person to testify, and then we're going to go to the sexual assault bill. So, Chip Wagner.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Chip Wagner, Executive Director of the Alaska Conference of Catholic Bishops, and I also will be brief. This bill is also known as the Lacey-Connor Act, in memory of Lacey and Connor Peterson, who were both killed in California, as you both know. The Church's position on life, I believe, is well known to this committee, in that we protect life from conception to natural death, and the person's dignity comes from God. And as such, we believe every individual has a right to life, but also has a right to those things that make life truly human: food, clothing, housing, health care, education, etc. Now, this bill recognizes that a child in the womb deserves protection just as you and I deserve protection. And this was dramatically brought home to me last year before the Senate Finance Committee, where the parents and children were speaking on behalf of the Key Campaign for Developmentally Disabled Children. And one of the moms stated, quote, "When you are pregnant, you have great and wonderful dreams for your child. And I believe that is really, really true. And if that child is taken away from that mom, then her life is shattered. Even though the child is still unborn, her life is shattered. And those people who are responsible, the responsible parties, should be held accountable, just as they would be if the child was in the mother's arms." So that's why we support this bill, and we thank you very much. And we also appreciate the fact that this committee has added back into the bill Senator Guess's recommended change on the domestic violence situation. We supported that in the Senate Finance Committee. We supported it in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And we're pleased to see the House Judiciary Committee put it in. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wagner. Questions? Okay, hearing none, we're going to go ahead and set Senate Bill 20 aside. Thank you, Senator Dyson, for being here. We'll bring it back up first thing on Wednesday. Okay. For the folks who joined later onto the testimony lines, my apologies. We will come back in again on Wednesday, so I'll leave public testimony open out of fairness. But the only thing I ask is, if you've already offered your testimony, please don't call again to offer your testimony. It's a part of the permanent record now. We appreciate it. So really just only those folks who are new to the equation. Okay, so we have, without further ado, the new super bill, which will be a combination of Representative Newman's House Bill 353 and Senate Bill 218. And I want to thank all the sponsors, Senator Guess, Senator Bundy, Representative Newman for your hard work, and we all know it's not about the credit, and so I want to thank Representative Newman for being so gracious as to allow the Senate bill to be the vehicle and to working long, hard hours with them. And so what I'll do at this point is if you have anything you want to add to the record, Representative Newman will go ahead and take it, and then what I'm really going to do is put House Bill 353 to the side now and take up or adopt in, I guess, Senate Bill 218 is kind of what I'm thinking. So you have a CS, is that?
Yes, Madam Chair. The CS for House Bill 353 version F does exactly what you've just stated, where it does fold the two bills together.
So we're setting aside the old version of it, if you will, and adopting, just so that it's clear, it's still a House bill, but it's essentially Senate Bill 218. Okay, so that's before us, and it's version F, and members should have a copy of that. Let me know now if you don't. And I'd appreciate a motion. Representative Wilson?
I move that we have CS for House Bill number 353, version F, before us.
Okay, as our working document, is there an objection to adopting 353, version F? Okay, hearing none, we have version F before us. Representative Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just briefly, may I state that in an effort to work along with the Senate to make sure that we protect all Alaskans from these abuses that are happening, I graciously accept the opportunity to bring these two together to make sure that this happens this year. Also, Madam Chair, members of this committee, I want to thank you for taking up time to hear this legislation. And again, today we want to offer the CS that will address some of the issues previously raised in this committee. Over the last few days, I've worked with Senator Bundy to come up with a more comprehensive legislation to deal with these issues and ask to invite him to introduce this CS also. I want to note the work that Senator Gretchen Guess has done to develop this legislation, and I'm very happy to work with both of them in crafting this much-needed bill. But, Madam Chair, before moving on to Senator Bundy's introduction to the CS, I'd like to respond to a comment that was left hanging in this last hearing. Representative Guerra has rightfully left us thinking about the real people this bill impacts. And that's the victims and not so much the defendants in this case. It's the real people. With that in mind, a member of my staff who's worked very long and hard on this bill asked that I give him a moment to please address the committee.
Thank you, Representative Newman.
Madam Chair, Rex Shattuck, staff to Representative Newman. I thought long and hard about my quick comments this morning before I asked Representative Newman if it was acceptable that we have this brief discussion. I'd also like to thank you, Madam Chair, and the rest of the committee for bringing up this legislation. And Representative Newman and Senator Bundy and Senator Guess and their yeoman's work to try and fix this issue as far as presumptive sentencing and the other aspects of it. I also wanted to, as a person who's had personal experience in this issue, take a moment to put a real face on the issue and tell you that I'm thank you for many people who have had to deal with this. I'm not comfortable with giving all the details of my experience, but I'm one of the lucky people who at a young age of 11 dealt with what would be considered a Class B felony, touching through clothes, with some other solicitations that went along with it. And there was not only myself, and to this week there were none other than five people who knew this. And going through this bill, I spent a little bit of time kind of thinking and felt that it was necessary to speak for those people that we've identified who don't typically come forward, don't typically have the opportunity, and felt it was important for me to kind of put a face on it. And I thank you for that. I was 11 when it happened, and I'm now 49. And that's a sentence of 38 years and growing without parole. And I understand that we should have some recognition of the defendants, but the victims also are a key part of this. And I urge you to remember that as you're going through this. There's some big disparities between the sentencing of the defendant and the victim, and I thank you for taking this issue up, and I appreciate you addressing it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank both of you. Okay, I'm going to go to Senator Bundy and Senator Guest, please. Judiciary. Flip a coin.
For the record, Gretchen Guest, Senate seat J.
And Con Bundy, Senate seat P. Madam Chair, committee members, there seems little I could add to the importance of this bill after the testimony you just had. But I would like to also add my personal thanks. I don't know if this is new ground, but it's interesting at least that it's not only a bipartisan bill, but it appears to be a unicameral bill. And I think this speaks to the importance, as was very eloquently pointed out just previously, of addressing this issue. I certainly also want to thank the staff of all the people involved, Representative Newman and Senator Guest and myself, and Portia and Susan have been, Dean have been,
yes,
just absolutely critical in the development, because what we're doing is trying to walk that fine line of protecting our citizens, but not being overly draconian to people who are violators, perpetrators, and in many, too many cases, predators. If I might, and I wasn't here for previous testimony, but just share some of my views for the record before we go on to the CS. You know, we have this, Alaska has this disgusting reputation of having the highest sexual assault rate in the nation, highest by 70%. We're 70% greater than the nearest other state. And I think, as indicated by the previous testimony as well, those are just the reported cases. And so often, this is really the tip of the iceberg kind of experience for people when you've got an adult who reaches and well into adulthood before they're able to talk about this. We can understand why many of our victims don't come forward. It's indicated, you know, that as I said, the victims that do come forward are the tip of the iceberg. Those that get convicted because of the fairness of our legal system are even a smaller percentage. So when we think about the fact that we have such a high sexual assault rate, remember we're only dealing with just a small part of that, and I tell you that because I think it adds emphasis to the cooperative work that you've seen before you and the need that we press forward, I think, with a good bit of enthusiasm, if you will, so that we can stop creating new victims. The unfortunate, and you all have information in your packet, the unfortunate reality is that it's very difficult for people who are sexual offenders to change. Rehabilitation is not very likely, and the only guarantee we have to protect the public from creation of new victims is to remove the victimizer from society. And that's what this bill essentially does. It says we're going to have to insulate society from people that would cause inflict these lifelong wounds on our children and on the women in our society. We have had testimony in the past and other hearings that, well, the people that do this are under the influence of drugs or alcohol. Madam Chair, I confess, not lately, but in my youth, I have probably overindulged in alcohol. But never once, after overindulging in alcohol, have I felt a need to abuse a child or rape a woman. And so I think that's not an excuse that I accept. Alcohol or other drugs remove inhibitions, but the basic sexual drive to be an abuser, a rapist, has to be there to begin with. And so I again reiterate that I think while this is a drastic step, it's one that we need to take. It's an expensive step, but it's one we need to take. And with that, if it's your pleasure, we can discuss the CS.
Yes, please.
Gretchen, anything you'd like to add before we...
Do you mind? Madam Chair, before we get started, I did have a couple prepared remarks because I didn't know if I was going to be here today. I am one of 8 co-sponsors on the Senate side, and I wanted to read who the co-sponsors are. Those of you who have been in the building for a while will chuckle at the list. Senator Dyson, Senator Elton, Senator Kukesh, Senator Green, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, Senator Seekins, and myself. I don't know if that's ever happened. I think it represents from our side of the building the diversity that this bill has, both in geographic and party distribution. I had put in a bill on sexual abuse of a minor and have joined forces with Senator Bundy on this bill and appreciate him allowing me to do that, and we'll talk to the specific changes that I made. Honestly, this bill before you is too lenient in my mind, if I would have had my druthers, but it has been worked on. I have no tolerance for this issue, and so I appreciate the work that was done in the Senate, but please don't think that what's coming out of the Senate is something is the upper level and hasn't been compromised already. You know, we talk a lot about stats needing to protect the public, and I think, and if you look at 1255 or 005, the reason for sentencing, my motivation behind this bill is really about values. It's not about protection, and it's not about the stats. We are a policymaking body, and we are supposed to reflect the values of our communities. Oh, sorry, my sinuses are, this pregnancy has wreaked havoc on my sinuses.
I had the same experience.
Well, during pregnancy.
I have.
So my apologies.
I have sinus too, but I didn't know the reason for it.
Oh, see, it's catching. And so I think, when I think about this bill, I think about policy, and I think about the values that we have. And I think about, you know, my district, which Representative Anderson and Gruenberg are the House members, and Representative Guerra's district, I represented half of that in the House. And I think if you took my typical constituent and said, do you know that a rapist gets 5 years and a child molester gets 3 years and they can be out in 2/3 time, I think they would be shocked. I don't think that represents at least the values in our district and in those areas that I represented. And I don't think as the state as a whole. But they count on us to what are the values in our community and what should be the laws reflecting those values. And sex crimes, like no others, have always been pushed under the rug. You know, we don't talk to them. It's a family issue. It's a community issue. It's the, unfortunately still, what did she do to deserve it issue. It hit me a couple days ago on this that it took me 3 years with a majority sponsor to pass a bill only 3 years ago that said the Violent Crimes Compensation Board couldn't blame the rape victim for being raped. I mean, we have been behind in our legislation on this issue, and it's been because of how we've thought about this issue over time. So although some question why the dramatic increase, my question is, how can we not? And how can we not actually reflect on the values in our community and what those values are and finally start discussing this issue? So I respectfully and we had this testimony in the Senate, and I don't know if it will come over here, but I dismiss the notion that some rapes and molestations are serious and some are not. They all are very serious. And I think that they have serious consequences on the victim, and I think they, and as you've heard today, and on the community. So as we work through this bill, at least for me, not necessarily, you know, for other people related to the bill, to me it's not because we're the rape capital of the nation, and it's not because we know that those who have raped and molested have done it hundreds of times before they've gotten caught, and it's not because we prosecute too little and plead too much. It's really about the one case. And do the current sentencing guidelines reflect the values of what we believe this crime is just in that one case? Everything else amplifies it. And I think it does so in an important way. But I think if you come down and think about the one rape case or the one molestation case, and you look at our sentencing guidelines, our values and our guidelines don't match right now. And I think this bill at least comes closer to matching those. With that, I will go into explaining the first two sections of the bill because they were sections from my original bill, and it's something I'm actually fairly passionate about. The first two sections...
If I might, before we start there, may be some other precedent setting going on here. Senator Guest being, let's jail them all and let God start it out, and I'm the moderator of the influence.
So noted.
My guidance from here on this.
Yes, those of you who are around for high school qualifying exam debates will be shocked.
I was around.
Section 1 of the bill came from my bill, and what it does is right now these two penetration crimes are third degrees, and they move these up to second degrees. I am a strong believer, especially with SAM cases, sexual abuse of minor cases, that the penetration crime should be the first or the second degree, that we shouldn't have penetration crimes or attempted in the third and the fourth degree. They're serious crimes. Some people like to dismiss them. You know, well, it's the coach and the player. I had a friend in one of these situations. They're serious crimes. You know, I'm sorry, but if you're in a position of authority, you shouldn't be sleeping with someone under 18. And if you can't wait, something's wrong. And the consequences from them are serious. So we move those up. So when it comes to sexual abuse of a minor, every penetration crime is in either the first or the second degree and out of the third degree, and therefore the attempt to do that out of the fourth degree, which is a misdemeanor right now. Section 2 of the bill is the failure to report a sex offender or kidnapper. This came in, I'm not sure if it was discussed in 343, but this came similar out of Florida. And the Jessica Lunford Act, it basically says if you know someone's a sex offender and you know that they're not registering, it's a Class A misdemeanor. It's trying to get people to be responsible to the community at large for these situations. It was the case in Florida that the offender in that case was living with his sister who knew he wasn't registered, knew he was a sex offender, and didn't do anything about it. And so that section also comes from the first bill, and I know Department of Corrections probably can comment on that as well. The rest of the bill I will let Senator Bundy discuss.
Yes, Representative Groenberg.
Looking at subsection B, line 3 through 6 on page 3, I don't see Mr. Wagoner here, but I appreciate that there's a defense in the attorney-client relationship. How about for a priest? In the course of the priest-penitent relationship?
Through the chair, Representative Groenberg, it's a good question that hasn't come up. Let me see if I can get you an answer during this hearing.
As you may recall, and the members of this committee will recall, Representative Lynn had a very controversial bill that dealt with exactly that issue, and it engendered extremely hot debate, and clergy in this state were not totally unanimous on one side or the other, I might say, but it's something that was quite a fight on the House floor, and the bill went over to the Senate and it never emerged, so it's not law, but I'd like you to think about that.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, where are you being told by staffs that priests are not covered in this situation? But let me double-check on...
No, they're not covered under the bill.
Yeah.
And the question is, should they be?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I think this is a good first step on a difficult issue, and I don't think at this time I would feel comfortable broadening it. I think that's a policy decision of its own in the legislature about what the role should or should not be.
He's jumping at the bit. Representative Newman.
Madam Chair, I think more people can be at the stand here. You're all welcome to come up.
Representative Newman.
A very good example of how the Senate and the House can work together. Just in addressing Representative Grunberg through the chair, Madam Chair. You know, when we look at a priest, a lot of people look at a priest in different ways. You know, is a priest a part of the Catholic religion?
But I meant it in the broader sense, the clergy.
Okay, you know, I mean, so trying to get into that definition, I think, really clouds the issue, and I think probably keeping it the way it is probably the best.
I just would refer, Madam Chair, to the evidentiary rule, which escapes me at the moment, but there's a clergyman privilege, and it's a very broad privilege.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I think part of our discussion in this arena was, while there is this confidentiality on one hand, I think there is also, both for attorneys as well, to not be a knowing participant in a crime. And we'll welcome further discussion here, but one thing to... have some awareness is another to be a participant by not reporting the person.
Representative Kerr?
Madam Chair, Senator Guess, I think, since this is your provision, I think that it's a minor part of the bill I'm going to ask you about, but it's important because it's in the bill. When on your child kidnapper provision, page 3, line 7, there is page 3, line 7.
Yes.
I know that I believe that you probably intend kidnapping the way we all understand it. Somebody takes a child, in the colloquial sense, and that's the worst form of kidnapping. There are, I believe, in the statutes the way it's defined, it also includes somebody violating a visitation or custody order. That kind of kidnapping is included as kidnapping. So you take your child on a weekend. You weren't supposed to take the child. Somebody else knows you have the child. They, I believe, are now a misdemeanor the way this is written. Would you have any problem if we define child kidnapping not to include the kind of kidnapping that's involved in sort of custody violations and visitation order violations?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, thank you for that question. I would not have any problem, and I don't. I'm looking to Senator Bundy. That wasn't the intent, and that's not when we were working with the drafters the intent. So, if there needs to be some clarification, I do not mind doing that.
We'll take a look at it. Thanks.
Representative Wilson,
thank you, Madam Chair. I want to follow up less on what you just said because we would want to keep that in there. Because it follows along if they knowingly participated. I mean, if they're doing something wrong, it doesn't matter whether they're if they're doing something wrong, then they need to be taken care of. I mean, you know, we need to protect the child, whether it's with a real parent or not.
Representative Kerr?
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I agree, and it's already a crime to take somebody, to take a child in violation of a custody or visitation order. That part is already a crime. But what this says is, if you know that your boyfriend has just shown up with his kid on a weekend that he wasn't supposed to have his kid under the custody order, and you don't call the cops, then you've now committed a crime.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Mayor.
Senator Guess?
Correct me if I'm wrong, through the chair, Representative Guerra. If you look at page 2 at the bottom, it talks about recklessly disregards the fact that the sex offender child kidnapper has not complied with the sex offender, that's the sex offender registry, and knowingly fails to report the location of the child sex offender or child kidnapper to the Department of Public Safety. So I don't believe, unless that person is a child kidnapper, in fact, I don't know if actually your scenario would work, because in this case, it's people that are sex offender or child kidnapper that are told they have to register and don't register. And it's that narrow group. It's difficult because it's on two pages, and in C kind of, you know.
No, I think that might be right. Thanks.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Yeah. I think that is right, once you see the connection, because it references 1156840, which is the sex offender registry list. Okay. Further questions?
We want you to keep doing that, but on this section, before we let
you go from one in sections one and two.
Okay.
Representative Gruenberg.
This might impact some of the other privileges in the rules of evidence. It could be impact, I'm talking about the reporting thing here. It might impact, for example, a psychotherapist patient privilege and some of these others. And maybe I'm wrong. Does this also have that these are indirect rule changes? I think you need to look at that and make sure that this is constitutional in that respect.
She's talking. Is Annie Carpinetti your lawyer on this bill, or is Susan?
Susan.
Susan, I'm sorry to do that to you, but if you could just for a second, the question that has come up just before we dispense with Section 1 and 2 regards the mandatory reporting provision under Section 2. My gut instinct is that any time you make a crime of reporting a crime, that doesn't change the fact that there is another section of the law that regards privilege, and that the two are taken together. And so unless you specify otherwise, this isn't doing anything to change the privileges that exist in law. But Representative Gruenberg's inquiring about it, if you could put something on the record.
For the record, Susan Parks, Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division. Madam Chair, actually, I think much like the statute that requires certain folks to be mandatory reporters of child abuse, even doctors, I think that if you as the policymakers can decide for this kind of purpose, the privilege isn't going to apply, that there's a greater good out there, such as reporting child abuse, such as reporting failure to register. So I think legally you would have to exempt them out like you have the lawyers here specifically.
Okay.
I think a statute can override the privilege in an evidence rule, because that's all that is an evidence rule.
Through the chair, it wasn't whether we could do it or not, Ms. Parks. It was more whether we had to. I don't think that it. I think my question was not necessarily well taken, actually. Whether we'd have to say that this isn't.
It's
an indirect rule change, but it really isn't, because it doesn't involve in-court procedures here.
Right.
Madam Chair, it's the evidence rules, the privilege is a rule of admissibility of evidence, and I see this as a separate thing, and
right.
It's really a policy call by this body on whether you're going to give certain people, like a defense attorneys, a pass on reporting.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Good. All right. So the rest of the bill. Senator Bundy?
Further questions? You're ready for a motion?
Yes.
This would take us to page 3, section 3, lines 9 through 12. This is a very important aspect of the bill. This section includes the polygraph testing that's a mandatory aspect of probation. And again, some of the information that I've given you, when they began using a polygraph, and we all know it's not admissible in court, but apparently it's very effective in probation and parole, and Portia Parker's here can speak to that and greater length. But when people were under probation and parole and they were subject to a polygraph, apparently it's harder to lie to yourself and lie to others if you have a machine to check on you. And their compliance with their parole, have you been stalking people, how are you hanging around playgrounds, whatever it was, went up almost 70%. And the compliance without that is just over 20%. So it's very effective in the probation and parole, and other states have found it to work very well. We've had some anecdotal comments that it's worked so well that people who are offenders in other states have said, I want to go to Alaska, I want to be transferred, my parole transferred to Alaska, where they don't have this polygraph, or I think we had, it was a case where an Alaskan offender was saying, yeah, I want to go such and such state, I don't deal well with the polygraph. So just wanted to, we're quite enthusiastic about that, and hope you will join us. And I'll just keep moving on if until there are questions. In page 3, section 4, lines 20 to 23, this section deals with the increase of presumptive sentencing terms. Includes higher sentences for offenders who sexually assault victims who are under the age of 13. And I think many of us agree that the young children are the most egregious of the egregious. For sexual assault and abuse that fall under an unclassified sex felony, the first offense is 25 to 30 years if the victim was under the age of 13. And let me interject here that one of the comments we heard on the criticisms we heard on the Senate side is, well, we've just fallen victim to this national hysteria that you, some of you have heard about, the Jessica's Law. And I know that we were working on this long before, we collectively, before there became a national hysteria, if there is indeed one. And it just was an unfortunate alignment of the planets that our bill has come before you at a time where it's also a national concern. So under the age of 13, 25 to 30 years, if the victim was 13 or older, 20 to 30 years. If they're it's a first offense, but the defendant used a weapon, firearm, caused serious injury, that's a 25 to 35. If the offense is a second felony conviction, but the first was not related to sexual assault, it's 30 to 40 years. If the offense is a second felony conviction and the defendant has a prior felony, it is 35 to 45. If the offense is a third conviction, but the previous were not two felony convictions, it's 40 to 60. And if it's if they're a three-time loser with three felony sexual convictions, it's 99 years. We currently have a three strikes bill on the law on the books, and that I was happy to be part of. And this simply adds, I think, an important addition to that three strikes law. For Class A felonies, the first offense is 20 to 25 years for under 13 and 15 to 25 if they're older. If the first offense involved a firearm or weapon, it's 25 to 35. If the offense is a second conviction, again, but not the first felony, a sexual felony, it's 25 to 35. If the offense is a second felony conviction and they had a previous sexual felony, it would be 30 to 40. If the offense is a third conviction, but the prior two were not sexual felonies, it's 35 to 50. And again, a third conviction, a three-time loser on sexual felonies, it's 99 years. For Class B, the first offense is a range of 5 to 15. If, again, a weapon was used, it's 25 to 35. If the offense is a second one, but not two sexual felonies, it's 10 to 25. If it's a second felony conviction and the second sexual felony conviction, it's 15 to 30. By the way, in your packet, there will be a chart showing these sentencing things. I'm just going through it for the record. If it's a third conviction and the two priors were not sexual felonies, it's 20 to 35. And again, if it's a third conviction, three sexual felonies, it's 99 years. For Class C felonies, the first offense is 1 to 12 years. if the it's a second conviction, but the first sexual, it's 8 to 15. If it's a second conviction and a second sexual felony, it's 12 to 20. If the offense is a third conviction, but the previous two were not sexual felonies, it's 15 to 25. And again, a third conviction of three sexual felonies, and it's 99 years. And I just feel a need to interject. Remember, by the time they're convicted three times, there are literally hundreds of victims out there. Moving on to page 6, section 5, lines 16 to 17, habitual criminals must serve half their sentence before filing a motion for sentence reduction. If you have additional questions, Ms. Parks can address that as well. But it is, again, as Senator Guess had said, establishing our community standards. And do we want to have what is sometimes considered a revolving door in our prisons? On page 6, section 6, lines 24 and then 26 to 28, requires habitual criminals to receive 99 years without the possibility and the current of 40 years. The current three strikes law just said 40 to 99. On page 7, section 7, line 4 through 13, this allows for mandatory probation as part of a regular sentencing. And it turns out that that there are some sexual offenders who will do what's called flat time. Rather than take an early out and be under parole or probation, rather than be under any supervision, they'll do their full sentence in an attempt then to not be under supervision. And again, this leads to the recidivism problem that we're concerned about. For unclassified sexual felonies, it's 15 years probation. For Class A or B sexual felonies, it's 10 years probation. And Class C, it's 5 years probation. This is mandatory probation, cannot be suspended or reduced, and the defendant is subject to all the rules of probation under this requirement, which, when this bill passes, would include the polygraph test. On page 7, section 8, line 30, and page 8, lines 10 and 12, these are two housekeeping amendments. The Department of Law has said there's a current loophole that two offenders have used to avoid registering as a sexual offender. And again, Susan Parks will be able to speak to that if you have questions on that section. Page 9, section 10, lines 20 to 22. This amends current probation requirements to require sexual offenders to submit to regular polygraph testing. And the sexual offense is defined under AS 12.63.100. Page 9, section 11, line 26, this increases the penalty for failure to report sexual abuse from Class B misdemeanor to a Class A. This applies to those that are required to report such sexual abuse, teachers, etc. The same penalty as a failure to report an offender that has not been complied with came to us from Senator Dyson, so it's part of the collaboration. Page 9, section 12, line 28, and this is Senator Guess's amendment that took sexual abuse of a minor in the third grade up to the second degree. Page 9, section 13, line 29, through page 10, line 8, requires the Department of Public Safety to provide access to sexual offender information on the Internet in a map or a geographic format. Page 10, section 14, line 14 to 15, extends the polygraph requirement for individuals on probation or parole for sexual offenses to those individuals who were sentenced and convicted before this legislation goes into effect. And we've had a thorough discussion about habeas corpus and all your other technical concerns, and this have been assured by attorneys is constitutional. Page 10, section 15, line 16, allows the Department of Correction to implement the polygraph requirements. page 10, section 16, line 17 and 18, implements the sentencing aspect as well as other aspects of this bill to go into effect on immediate passage. And that takes us through the changes in the CS that's before you. The sentencing increases are substantial, but unfortunately I feel compelled to tell you that if there's even one mitigator, the judges can choose to reduce the sentence substantially. So we, when you first take a look at this, it seems like a really substantial change, and it is, and it should be. However, there's still discretion for judges allowed, and the of course the one of the discussions that you will probably have, and we've had before, is that as Senator Guest had referenced, this is a societal norm that we're setting, and we have to be able to provide the courts with justification that some of these sentences for sexual assault are equal or even greater than, say, manslaughter. But I think you had previous testimony here that indicates that a life sentence occurs in many cases for victims. So it's a policy call, and I strongly agree with Senator Guest that this also establishes what we as a society feel is acceptable. And reiterate that the only guarantee that a sexual offender will not reoffend is to remove them from society. And I feel it's a cost, in all senses of the word, that we should pay.
Thank you, Senator Bundy. Thank you, Senator Guest and Representative Newman. I do have folks online to testify. What I think I'd like to do is take their public testimony and go ahead and have you guys come back Friday and mark up the bill then, because there are folks waiting online and I don't want to disrespect their time. So, Representative Wilson.
Thank you for your time.
Thank
Grandpa
you.
Grandpa Bundy,
Senator.
And Gretchen.
We commend you.
Thank you. Okay, Homer, LIO, Ginger Bryant. And if I could just make the blanket statement to the folks online, there are many of you. If you could try to confine your testimony to 2 minutes, I would be appreciative, and just sort of hit those salient points that you think the committee needs to know. And our fax number is 465-6592, 465-6592. And so to the extent that there's written testimony that you'd like to be part of the record, we'd be happy to do so. Okay, so Ms. Bryant.
Yes, thank you. My name is Ginger Bryant, and I'm representing South Peninsula Haven House. And I just want to go on record as saying that this bill is imperative that it passes. With the services that we provide, I can't tell you how many times we see victims and we get them, you know, back on track and doing what we need to do, and then we are constantly, then we have a new set of victims from the same perpetrator again and again. People who do not know if these laws, if a perpetrator is put back into a community and they're not polygraphed, there's no sentencing, that there's no way to actually confirm that these people are not reoffending, then they just slip under the wires. They're smooth operators, they know what to do. Polygraphing and sentencing and really holding these people accountable for their actions is the only way to protect the victims, and they have multiple victims, and I just need to be on record as saying this is a vital bill, and I really cannot stress enough that it needs to be passed. This concludes my testimony.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bryant. Okay, next I'm going to go to the Anchorage LIO. And just go in order of the folks that are listed here. Leslie Hyhart?
It's Hebert.
Hebert. Sorry, there's an H printed out here. Ms. Hebert.
I'm here in my private capacity, although I'm also a public defender type lawyer. I'm here to speak against the sentencing bill in particular. The in my practice, what I've seen is people getting the actual facts of a case can get distorted through the task of prosecuting it in a way that I don't think the legislature intends, but which is very predictable from the result of the sentencing bill. This legislature, or a legislature, adopted a presumptive sentencing scheme in order to avoid disparate sentences, and that presumptive scheme included sex offenses regarding adults as well as the sex offenses regarding minors. And it is the intent of the legislature that the scheme of presumptive sentencing avoid disparate punishment for similarly situated offenders. When you have lesser offenses in the B and C felony range, and that's those are affected by this bill, and you make a range that is so broad, 5 to 15 years for a first felony offender in the B felony range and 1 to 12 years for the Class C felony range, some similarly situated offenders are going to get, for the same offense and same conduct, one will get 15, one might get 5, with no apparent justification. So it's a system that's set up that's going to encourage the results that this legislature was trying to avoid in adopting in 1980 the whole presumptive sentencing scheme. Also, when you have conduct in sex assault 2 in particular, the B and C felony ranges, the conduct that is prohibited, for instance, in the B felony is touching without consent. That's a sexual assault 2. Touching without consent is different than calling somebody or what I think this legislative body has heard as rapist. Touching without consent is grabbing a breath. And it is often just between two people whether that was consensual touching or not. He says, yes, it was consent. She says, no, it wasn't consent. And so what you come down to is, who is the jury going to believe? And when you're at that level, and you have this kind of a sentencing range, even innocent people will avoid trying that case before a jury because the innocent person will get more than likely convicted. And this, you know, this legislative body's attempt to increase the punishment is just a reflection of society's interest in punishing the sex offender, and it translates in a way so that innocent people are caught up in this. And they end up taking a felony conviction for in order to avoid the draconian sex felony conviction consequences, such as registering as a sex offender. In my practice, I've had a 19-year-old accused of having penetration with the 15-year-old. The 15-year-old was in the juvenile system. She was a delinquent. She was very sexually active. And my client was, maybe it may have been his first sexual encounter. And when I go before it, I went to the jury with that one, and as a result, the prosecution offered him a non-sex crime resolution in the middle of trial. So, sure, you can believe that what you're doing is protecting the victim, but it's not always true that what you're going to do with these draconian sentences, they're extremely wide range for conduct that includes fairly limited conduct. I think you're going to have a lot of unintended consequences. I've also heard someone talk about trusting prosecutorial discretion not to prosecute cases that are not supposed to be prosecuted. And that's, again, where you're going to get disparate impact. You're going to have disproportional minorities represented in either the prosecution, investigation, or incarceration. So, to me, in 2005, the legislature dropped the increases in the sentences. They haven't been tried. They haven't been tested, and there's no reason to increase them now. And I think it's very bad news.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hebert. Philip Sharahan.
Shanahan, thank you. I too am an attorney in town, and I'm testifying in my own capacity as a citizen. The problem I see with the bill at this point is that the goal of punishing sex offenders more harshly could be a laudable goal, perhaps, except the term sex offender, as it's defined in our statute, includes people who have done very, very many different types of behaviors. I'm not here to tell you that every person convicted of a sex offense is not a dangerous person, but it's also very, very incorrect to assume that anybody who's convicted of a sex offense therefore poses a future danger. The repeat sex offender cases, perhaps those, yeah, I'm not here to tell you that they don't deserve lengthy jail terms. What I want to talk to you more about is the sentences that have been proposed for first-time offenders. Traditionally, our sentencing scheme has punished first-time offenders with lengthy jail time only for the most egregious acts, the penetration, the actual rapes, the molestations, the child molester cases I heard mentioned earlier. The Blakely bill then came along last year, just the same legislature. It was all the same folks who were there in Juneau now passed the Blakely bill. That bill just took effect in March, and it now changed the old scheme, and it added some minimum penalties for the lower-level conduct, the Class B and the Class C felonies. That went into effect in March of 2005. We're now here, I guess, 8 or 9 months later, maybe 10 months, no, I guess my math's bad, 11 months later. And that bill itself marked quite a change over the past 25-plus years in Alaska. Our presumptive sentencing laws didn't punish first-time offenders for the lower-level conduct with lengthy jail terms. The Blakely bill actually, in and of itself, changed that. And I heard Senator Bundy mention that this has been worked on long before any of the national concern, but how long before could it have been when this same legislature, just less than 1 year ago, did a complete overhaul of our sentencing scheme and adopted new sentences for all of our felony crimes? And what this bill now does is change those sentences that were just increased in March without any chance to really see if they're going to have any positive impact, and you know, quadrupled in some cases, doubled in some cases, in other cases just come up with huge ranges that didn't exist before. I think what we're falling into the trap of is comparing the rapist to the person who tries to grab the girlfriend's breast through her clothing and she says no, and then he does it again. Is that person in the same category as the person who violently rapes somebody? I don't think anyone's going to argue that they are. But this bill seems to assume that. This bill talks about increasing penalties for rapists and child molesters, but in fact the numbers that are being applied to the first offenders convicted of the lower level crimes really doesn't make much of a distinction between the conduct. And I agree with some of the testimony earlier that you just heard about the broad ranges seem a bit different than we would expect. And the Class C felony offense, just to some briefly touch on that one, that can include the attempt to touch the breast through the clothing. And now we've got a range of 1 to 12 years for somebody who could be 50 years old and have done not a single thing wrong in their life. And our sentencing scheme has always addressed people's histories by saying if you have a bad history, you get treated worse later. But what this bill does is it takes away that sort of policy, and it seems to say if you're a first offender and you do anything that constitutes quote-unquote a sex crime, you must have hundreds of victims and you must be very, very dangerous, so we're going to lock you up for a really long time. That's a dramatic change in our law. Again, I don't quarrel with the idea of presumptive terms that are steep for people who are repeat sex offenders, but we shouldn't assume that every person's a repeat sex offender when they have their first offense. And finally, just Senator Bundy also mentioned that finding of a single mitigator gives the judge lots of ability to reduce penalties, but a true understanding of the presumptive sentencing bill will defy that statement. The presumptive sentencing laws limit the number of mitigators are extremely limited, and they continue to be limited over the years. More and more of them get deleted from the statutes. And also, depending upon what the start of the presumptive term is, a judge can only reduce the penalty so far. Just as an example, the 5-year minimum on the first felony on the Class B, the lowest the judge could go is 2.5 years with mitigating factor.
If you can wrap it up, I don't mean to be rude, but you're at 6 minutes.
I just ask the legislature to take those things into account.
Thank you.
when looking at the first offender sentences. Those are really where I'm focusing my testimony.
And I sincerely appreciate your comments. The fax number I gave earlier, 465-6592, if you'd like to submit any of those in writing, I'd be happy to make them a part of the record and make sure all the members see it as well.
Sure.
Representative Guerra.
When we consider this on Friday, are we going to have members from the DAs and the public defenders or OPA online to help us consult, or is this our chance, really?
If they decide to participate.
I'm going to say on the record, and I've spoken to some of the committee members, I think it's been completely distressing that the shift between last year and this year. Last year, I felt we were much better educated on the criminal bills because there was a representative from the public defenders and or from OPA, usually one of the higher management or heads of the agency here to help us with these bills. That we also got the prosecution perspective, and this year we're just not getting it from the official agencies from the defense bar, and I just don't think that's helpful at all. I do appreciate that members from the private bar are coming, but there's a certain amount of gravitas, I guess, that you get when you have the head or senior officials from both agencies on both sides of the case here. And I guess I would do anything to urge the upper leadership of the defense agencies to start showing up at these hearings, or the commissioner of the Department of Administration to come here and explain why that's not happening. I'm going to ask either Ms. Hebert or Mr. Shanahan a couple questions. Just so people understand, just so I understand, let me just make a comment, and then I'm going to ask them or Ms. Parks whether I'm right. The current ranges for them for a unclassified felony sex crime, for a first one, it's 8 to 12 years, but then if you prove the aggravators, it can go up to 99 years. So the judge has the discretion on the most serious cases to do a sentence all the way up to 99 years, but you just have to prove it's an aggravated crime and an especially serious one. When we go down to a Class A felony, the range is 5 to 8 years for a first offense, but the judge can bring it all the way up to 30 years if it's the most serious type of crime. Class B felony, these are the, there's a problem in the law in Class B and Class C felonies is they cover a huge range of conduct, but among the conduct is sexual contact, which is defined as touching somebody through their clothes to touch the area below the belt or their breasts. So through a sweater, through pants, that's a crime. All of those should be crimes, but right now for those lower level ones, the Class Bs and the Class Cs, the range is 2 to 4 years or 1 to 2 years, but can be upped if it's an aggravated crime to 10 to 20 years. So the ranges are a little bit, are not the full picture. The ranges are what the judge can sentence you to if there are no aggravators in the case. But if there are aggravators, the judge can go up to the 99 or the 30 or the 20 or the 10. And I'm going to ask some questions about how the aggravators work. But just so you know, some of the aggravators that justify a higher sentence are, they're in 1255-155. They include crimes that cause physical injury, crimes that manifest deliberate cruelty to another person. Well, both of those things are rape as we think of it, and the most serious of the crimes. And in those crimes, you can increase the sentence to the maximum. That's the sort of educational comment to bring people up to where we are in the sentencing scheme. I guess, Ms. Hebert, why don't I ask you this, and I'll ask Ms. Parks when she testifies whether she agrees. With the aggravators, the way we do them now, if it's an aggravated crime, are the aggravator elements, are they part of the main trial? So a person is charged with sexual assault. If the prosecution thinks that it's an aggravated crime, do they then present the aggravator at that time also during the same trial?
Representative Guerra, this is Mr. Shanahan answering. Ms. Hebert has actually had to leave, so if I could try to respond to your question.
Sure.
To be honest, it's hard to say yet because the Blakely bill is so new. My experience I've seen has shown, though, that the aggravating factor because of the Blakely decision by the U.S. Supreme Court does have to be proven to the jury. However, I believe the practice in many of the courts, and Ms. Parks could correct me if I'm wrong on this, has been to do what's called a bifurcated trial in some circumstances if the aggravating factor includes testimony that wouldn't be relevant to the guilt or innocence phase of the trial, then the jury wouldn't hear that until after deciding guilt or innocence, and then the jury would be asked to decide after that verdict has come back whether or not the state has proven the aggravating factor beyond a reasonable doubt.
It would be the same jury?
Usually the same jury, yes.
Okay. Thanks. For now, I think that's I wanted to do this sort of long educational comment, but also wanted to find out how the aggravators worked. I appreciate it. We don't have a committee chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Now we're going to go on to Sue Christensen, off-net. Can you hear us? Your mute might be on, Sue, if you're there. Oh, we just lost him. Okay. Go on to the next one. Let's go on then to Sydney Billingsley in Anchorage.
Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I've been a criminal defense lawyer in Alaska now for 20 years, and have had a substantial experience in defending people who have been accused of sex crimes. Not all of the people that I have represented it both as a public defender, a public advocate, and now for the last 11 years as a sole practitioner have been guilty. Some people I've been able to have the good fortune of representing before they've been charged with the offense, and we, through some great labors, have managed to keep them from being formally accused of committing these crimes. I say that because sometimes the innocent people are charged or accused of committing sexual offenses, and they are the most easily made accusations in the world to make, and they are the most difficult to defend because all a person has to do is say, this happened. There's generally no physical evidence available, no physical injury available, and no witnesses available other than the two individuals involved in the alleged behavior. Therefore, accusations can be easily made for whatever reasons by a person desiring to be a victim of these offenses, and they are very, very traumatic and difficult and expensive and frightening to defend. What the value decision I'm hearing has been made by the legislature in proposing this bill is, as a value or a policy of the state of Alaska, the decision will be to warehouse sexual offenders, regardless of their potential for rehabilitation, regardless of, to some degree, the level of offense they commit. And to do that requires, in my opinion, that the government dehumanize its own citizens to a degree. You are choosing to put a citizen in the position that you would choose, that you would put a an object to be stored in a box or a warehouse, and instead incarcerate them in prison. It's a value decision. I think that paying attention to the factors that cause sexual offenses may be a better way to look. Some of the factors that cause 67, at least two-thirds of the sexual offenses, are substance abuse. I recognize very clearly that that's not an excuse for abuse, but it is a causing factor of abuse. If you address the substance abuse, which is rampant, especially in rural Alaska, but the urban areas are no exception these days. If you address substance abuse, you may very, very well find yourself with a steep decline in sexual offenses. The other one of the large components or one of the large factors in causing people to grow up to be sex offenders is that they were once victims of sexual offense. So you're taking yesterday's victim that you expressed a great deal of concern, and rightly so, about today, and then saying, okay, now that you're an adult and you've committed an offense, which is sort of a, I won't say natural offspring, but an understandable or recognizable offspring of your own sexual abuse, you do this to another person, and now you are somebody that we are no longer going to regard with compassion. We are going to regard you as somebody that needs to be warehoused. Or potentially, you know, the rest of your productive years. I think this will greatly impact Native Alaskans. I think it will greatly impact rural Alaskans. There's a couple of reasons for that. One is the high level of substance abuse the small towns that people live in. I also think that there are some cultural norms in rural communities where younger people are involved with older people, and I don't mean grossly so, but I mean the 15-year-old or the 14-year-old and somebody who might be 18 or 19. And that is something that is part of the cultural norm of the communities in the outlying areas. And if somebody flies in from outside that community and sees this behavior going on, this person will be charged with an A or a B felony. The
Sydney, can you kind of finish up and pull it together?
I will. I don't think that these sentences will deter sex offenses. I don't think increased sentences will deter sex offenses any more than the death penalty deters murder. The death penalty does not deter murder. That's proved. I do not believe that increasing sentences for sex offenders will deter sex offenses. I think that what might be a good idea to think about if you really want to take the great leap forward on this bill is put a sunset on it. And if you don't have a decrease in sexual offenses in fill in the blank years, 3 years, 5 years, if you don't have a marked decrease in the percentage of sex offenses prosecuted in the state, you should sunset it. There's an idea. Otherwise, you're just running up your fiscal note, warehousing people, and you're not having the desired effect.
Okay.
If you have no questions, I'll stop talking.
Okay, thank you, Sydney. Next, we'll go back to Sue Christensen. Sue, are you online now?
Yes, I am.
Okay, go ahead and give us your testimony.
As a victim of incest, I want to give you some experience, personal experience. I don't know exactly when it began, but I would say around 8 years old, and it went on until I was 14 years old. The point of this was that it warped my whole outlook on life. It was not until I was 47 years old and got sober that I realized the impact of what it had done to my life. It gave me a life sentence. I am now almost 62 years old. I have never forgotten, I've never gotten over it, and I never will. The point is, I'm managing it. But why are we so intent on focusing on the poor old perpetrators and not valuing and protecting our innocent children? Now, we've lumped all these kids in there from the 17-year-olds or 16-year-olds, and then we've lumped them in with 13-year-olds. I want a separate bill that manages our children from birth to 13, the target age of pedophiles. If you penetrate a 2-year-old, it's a lot different than penetrating a 17-year-old. And that's where we get all muddled up in here, because people are looking at it and going, well, she was 14 or 15. But nobody can quibble with children under 13 or even under 10. How about limiting it between the ages of birth and 10? I've seen kids with 3-year-olds and 5-year-olds with STDs. Now, there is no excuse for that, culturally or anything. Not now and not ever. So that's just my opinion. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Sue. Next I have Megan Gahan.
Sure.
Yes, 1 second. Megan's on her way.
Representative Guerra.
Sue, are you still there?
Okay, she's here. Hi, good afternoon. My name is Megan. I'm calling from Bethel in support of HB 353. I would like to echo the alarm that in the state of Alaska, especially out in this area, that we face of the high numbers of sexual assaults and sexual abuse of minor cases. In my work here, I'm seeing the same offenders over and over and over again, and unfortunately, many of the same victims that are reporting sexual assaults and sexual abuse cases, not only from the same offenders, but from several. So we have victims that are going through
assaults, and as everyone has said up to this point in support of this bill, that we certainly don't want to see victims going through these assaults more than once. In this area, I'm meeting people that are afraid to be in their hometowns in Bethel and out in the villages because offenders are being released from jail before they're serving sentences or because their sentences are so short that they're back in the villages. And to me, that places responsibility for safety back on a victim and a victim's family when the offender is out in a very short time. And I think that sends a wrong message to our communities that you can get away with these offenses not serving much jail time, and again, putting that responsibility back on victims and placing blame back on victims. So I would like to thank you for your work on this bill, for putting responsibility in the right place, placing that accountability back on offenders of these crimes. I think there needs to be consistency in sentencing, putting accountability in the right place, and making sure that these assaults aren't happening over and over and over again. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sue, are you there? Representative Guerra had a question for you.
No.
She's not. Can you ask it to me? Okay. Sorry about that. Okay, two more people. Don Libby.
Yes, it's Dan Libby. And I want to say thank you, first of all, for allowing me the opportunity to testify. I'm a private lawyer here in Anchorage, testifying on behalf of myself. I'm testifying against the sentence provisions of House Bill 353. There's definitely not a disagreement about issues with serious sexual offenders, and I think I would reflect the concerns that the House representatives and Senate representatives have towards serious sexual offenders. But I do believe that the first-time offenders need to be examined more closely. And the reason I say that is because I believe the first-time offenders is going to, without question, include innocent people who have been charged. And I just want to talk for a minute about a case that happened right there in Juneau, which is State versus Richard Warren. And Richard Warren was charged with sexual abuse of a minor in the first degree based on his position as a babysitter at the time involving a girl under 13 years of age. The girl came back at a later point and said that her friend's mother had put her up to the trial testimony, and further discovery revealed that the mother was seeking custody of the young girl, and that in being successful in seeking custody, she would receive money from the state. Now, Judge Weeks, Larry Weeks, right there in Juneau, did an outstanding job of reversing the conviction on that case, and District Attorney Patrick Gullison did an outstanding job in dismissing the charges in that case, not before Richard Warren served more than 3 years. And I think it reflects back on the issue of there is no physical evidence in a number of these cases. There's no other witnesses and there's no injuries. It becomes the evidence of a testifying witness alone. And the jury system does not allow the ability to recognize wrongful charges to as great a degree as we would like. And with that being said, we have an issue where someone in Richard Warren's position under this bill would be subject to 25 to 30 years, and I don't think there's anyone here today that would like to see Richard Warren serve another day in jail. It was a very difficult case to defend, and it was just difficult to see any time that Richard had to spend in jail on those charges. And I do believe that the good senators and representatives here would like to take that into account and to, for the first time felony offenders, reduce those, make the margin lower, at the lower end for instance 25 to 30, make that a lower end, and then the judge will have the discretion to go in and examine the credibility of the evidence. If there are instances where somebody who's innocently charged, the judge may be able to reverse a conviction. But allow judges to do their job, the job that we trust them to do, and recognize when there is scant evidence, when there is problems with evidence, and people who are wrongfully charged don't spend a good part of their lives in jail. And I do believe there are mitigators that can come into play here, but the mitigators under this scheme for an unclassified felony, a mitigator would bring someone down to 12 years. It's frightening to think that someone in Richard Warren's position would serve 12 years. So I would just ask, I think the legislature has done remarkable work and would commend and ask that they continue to do so, but just ask that they strongly consider for the first felony offenders where a situation might arise that is really out of whack and gives those people the opportunity to get on the right track, because they're not in this class of serious offenders. They're not in the class of people that we would seek to target with this bill, and I don't think that there is disagreement among us here today on that. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you.
If there are no questions.
I have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Libby. And I apologize about your name. We're going to work with teleconferencing. That's the third name that's been printed wrong, so my apologies. Representative Gruenberg.
Mr. Libby, whatever happened when it was determined that the accusing person had put the girl up to this for improper purposes? Was any action taken against that woman?
Not to my knowledge that there was any action taken. Although I haven't followed it, it happened in Haines, Alaska, and I haven't followed it in the last probably 6 months. Nothing had happened to that point, and this was an event that occurred in 2003. And again, I think there should be consequences for that kind of conduct. And as a prosecutor, it may be a difficult task sometimes to do things even if the law provides, just because there are so many competing interests that a prosecutor is faced with. But without a doubt, District Attorney Patrick Gullison did a remarkable job in that case, and commend him highly for his work. Judge Weeks also did an excellent job, and it's a tribute to the legal system in Juneau.
Because you're familiar with the crime of suborning perjury, are you not?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I think that would be the first crime, if I were looking at the issue, the first crime I might consider as a prosecutor. It didn't happen in that case, although I would probably venture to say there's a chance it was considered, and maybe more than a chance that it was considered. And why it wasn't pursued, I wouldn't know, but I think there was certainly grounds there to pursue that, and you know, considerations were probably taken into account on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, I just have one last person, Michael Moberly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to testify in opposition to this bill. My understanding, I just walked in the door, is it's version F of 218 still?
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Yes, okay. It is. Sorry. Yes, it is.
I'm not sure whether the earlier testimony included a lot of the opposition regards to the proportionality, what the true focus of this bill is, you know, the small subset of offenders that are really the target, and whether or not such a broad sweeping increase in the overall sentence is absolutely necessary. My biggest concerns are with, by what some people may say, you know, is necessary. I don't know that it's necessary yet to make such changes. We haven't had the opportunity to see the effects of the 2003 and 2005 changes to the law, which do in fact address exactly those offenders that everyone is most concerned about. There is a parole ineligibility for repeat offenders. There are enhanced sentences. And I think that those provisions need to be given an opportunity to demonstrate whether they have the effect of what this bill is trying to achieve, so that no fix right now is necessary. The other thing is that we don't yet know even the fiscal impact of those changes, and then we're piling on top of it the changes that would dramatically increase the costs related to these types of offenses. My final concern, while it has been addressed in some of the modifications or amendments, is with the failure to report someone who's failed to register. It's just of concern to me that while professionals and licensed individuals do have mandatory reporting, common lay citizens generally don't have those types of obligations under the law. There are a few specific instances. There's a new statute within the last couple of years having to do with an obligation to intervene or report abuse of a child or sexual abuse of a child. And those types of things tend to arise from a moral obligation, something that we as citizens in the same communities should intervene and act upon. I don't believe that the failure to register is necessarily that type of conduct which we should impose upon common citizens an obligation to take action where usually the law doesn't require action at all. So I believe that this bill is premature, if possibly unnecessary, and I think that we should postpone any action in this type of area until we see the effects of laws that we already have and seem to be working, though we need to have some sort of record developed to make sure that whether or not this is a necessary step.
Okay, thank you. And my apologies, there is one person in Ketchikan that didn't get to me, Cynthia Carlson.
Hello.
Go ahead and offer your testimony, Ms. Carlson.
Okay. I'm in support of this bill. I'm coming from the perspective of the victims. I work with the victims. I work at the shelter, and I have seen the effects of sexual assault for adults and minors, and who have suffered from this crime. And we need to send a message that we will no longer tolerate this crime. As we all know, sex offenders reoffend when they get out of jail or prison. And that they need to be held accountable. I hear about the damages of the crime they committed are long-lasting from the victims. They have to go to counseling. They have to learn how to trust people again. And some damages are lifelong. The victims are left to pick up the pieces. I hear about the pain all the time. I spend time with the victims 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. And I've been working in this job for 6 years now. And so I can tell you firsthand what they go through. They suffer fear, pain. They have to learn to trust again, and so on. Those of us in Ketchikan want this bill to pass. We cannot any longer let sex offenders continue to reoffend and reoffend. Our children are precious to us, and we need to hold them accountable. And I myself have experienced the pain in my family, with acquaintances, and with the victims I work with. A light sentence sends a message to the victim that what happened isn't that bad, because I've been to court. A big part of my job is I go to court with the victims. I hear, because when they're talking to the lawyers and they're in front of the judges, they got to have all the facts and everything. But my piece of my work is I hear all the emotions that they go through when they're anxious and all of that. I hear all of that. When a victim of sexual assault had to go to trial, it's like they are reliving it all over again to go through all of that. And the offender gets a light sentence, sends a message to others. Was it worth it to go through all of this to get to a light sentence? They lose trust in the criminal justice system. So I just wanted to come across today from the perspective of the victims that I work with. And thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, with that, we're adjourned.